And that birthday music means that it's time to celebrate our listeners who are having a birthday today. And on April the 19th, Margaret Walsh of Missouri Valley, Pat Monthy of Jefferson, Marcella Hammond, of Altoona, and Mike Fell of Waterloo are all celebrating a birthday today. So happy birthday to Margaret Walsh, Pat Monthy, Marcella Hammond, and Mike Fell. If you're having a birthday today and we didn't get you on our birthday list, please give us a call at area code 515-243-6833 so we can get your name on our list. Today's celebrity birthdays, actor Eleanor Donahue turns 87, actor Tim Curry is 78, Tony Plana turns 72 today, music executive Suge Knight is 59, actor Ashley Judd is 56, jazz musician Madeline Peru is 50, actor James Franco turns 46 years old today, actor Kate Hudson turns 45 years old today, Hayden Christensen is 43, Catalina Sandino Moreno turns 43, comedian actor Ali Wong is 52, and actor Simu Liu turns 35 years old today. You're listening to IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service. If you are hearing us on your television on Iowa PBS and you're not an IRIS registered user, please give us a call at 515-243-6833 so we can get you on our list. We need to know who is listening in order to keep our services free. Now we will turn to today's obituaries.
Thank you, Scott. There are two obituaries today. Sherry Lee Bodden, 79, of Des Moines, died on April 14, is at Hamilton's Southtown Funeral Home. The service time is April 22nd at 1 p.m., and interment will be in Elm Grove Cemetery. Audrey Lang, 88, also of Des Moines, died January 24th. Is at Hamilton's near Highland Memory Gardens. The service time has not been settled yet, but it will be on April 20th at the Highland Memories Garden Cemetery. Back to the news, another political story. Poll, Trump cuts Biden's lead with young voters, from page 2. Sudhishka Kochi from USA Today, from Washington, D.C. President Joe Biden is losing support among young voters, according to a new poll, as his handling of the Israel-Hamas conflict and other issues have spurred dissatisfaction in the group. The Harvard Youth Poll, conducted among 2010 people ages 18 to 29, found Biden outperforming Trump 50-37%, among registered young voters, and 56-37 among likely young voters. Among all young adults below 30, those figures narrow, with 45% supporting Biden and 37% for Trump. 16% of Americans remain undecided. By contrast, the president had a much higher lead at this stage during the 2020 election, according to the poll. At that time, 60% of likely young voters under 30 supported Biden, while only 30% supported Trump, and 51% of all young adults supported Biden, while 28% supported Trump. The poll was conducted March 14 through 21, with a margin of error of plus or minus 3.2 percentage points. Seti Warren, the director of the Institute of Politics at Harvard University's Kennedy School of Government, said in a news release, "Young people today have clear concerns about where our country is heading, from worries about the economy, foreign policy, immigration, and climate. Young people across the country are paying attention and are increasingly prepared to make their voices heard at the ballot box this November. The Israel-Hamas conflict is one issue driving young voters to the polls. The poll found that more young Americans think Israel's actions are unjustified rather than justified. Immigration is also becoming a hot topic. While 53% of young Americans think there is a crisis at the southern border, 50% agree that immigrants improve the culture of the United States, and 45% oppose the construction of a wall. Other polls have also found that Biden has weak support among young voters. For instance, a USA Today Suffolk University poll released in January found that among registered voters under 35, Trump leads 37% to 33%. Experts say young voters nationally may ultimately decide the 2024 presidential race. In 2016, young voters helped Trump claim victory by either staying home or choosing a third-party candidate. In 2020, they helped Biden win by turning out in near-record numbers and skipping third-party options.
Thank you, Judith. Next, Biden pokes at Trump over hush money trial. This is written by Joey Garrison and appears on page 5A of the Des Moines Register. In a jab at Donald Trump, President Joe Biden publicly announced the former president's criminal trial in New York for the first time since it began this week. "Under my predecessor, who's busy right now," Biden said while comparing his Pennsylvania jobs record to that of Trump during a speech Wednesday at the United Steelworker Union's headquarters in Pittsburgh. There was little doubt what Biden was referencing, and the line drew laughter in response. "It's the most attention Biden has given in public to Trump's trial involving hush money payments he allegedly made to a former porn star. The trial could last 6 to 8 weeks, limiting the presumptive Republican nominee's movements on the campaign trail. During the first 2 days of a 3-day campaign swing in the Granite State, Biden attacked Trump aggressively. He slammed Trump's Mar-a-Lago values, referred to Donald Herbert Hoover Trump, and poked fun at the cratering stock performance of Truth Social, Trump's social media company. But he has refrained from discussing Trump's trial. Biden has used his Pennsylvania campaign blitz, which included a trip Thursday to Philadelphia, to make an economic case to working-class voters both he and Trump are courting in key battleground states. Biden has sought to cast Trump as an out-of-touch elitist who cares about the rich and didn't deliver on the manufacturing boom he promised. Addressing steelworkers in Pittsburgh, Biden put his weight behind the survival of the long-battered U.S. steel industry, vowing that Pittsburgh-based U.S. Steel Corporation will remain American-owned and threatening to raise tariffs on China imports of steel and aluminum. "I stand by you," he said, reiterating his opposition to the planned $14.9 billion sale of U.S. Steel, an iconic American brand for more than a century, to Japanese-based Nippon Steel Corporation. "It should remain a totally American company, American-owned, American-operated by American union steelworkers, the best in the world," Biden said, "and that's going to happen, I promise you." Ahead of the November election, Biden is looking to improve Democratic performance with white, working-class voters without college degrees who have increasingly moved to the Republican camp in the Trump era. On Wednesday, he turned his attention to China, embracing a trade tactic often deployed by Trump during his presidency by threatening to triple the 7.5% tariff rate on Chinese steel and aluminum to 25%. Biden accused China of overproducing steel, flooding the global markets at artificially lower prices, and undercutting American steel, which is subject to higher environmental standards during production. Biden ordered U.S. Trade Representative Catherine Tai to conduct an investigation into China's trade practices in shipbuilding following a petition by United Steelworkers that alleged China is pursuing aggressive non-market policies that have allowed it to dominate the global market.
And a final story from Section A. UN leader advocates two-state solution, calls on Israel to protect Palestinian population. This story by John Bacon for USA Today. The Middle East is on the precipice of a broader war that can be averted with a two-state solution, allowing Israel and Palestine to exist side by side with Jerusalem as a shared capital. United Nations Secretary General Antonio Guterres told the Security Council on Thursday. Guterres's comments come as Tehran warned it has the ability to strike Israeli nuclear sites if Israel targets Iran nuclear facilities. Guterres said a two-state solution to the Israeli-Palestinian crisis is the basis of UN resolutions, international law, and previous agreements. The current Israeli government, however, has shown little interest in relinquishing control of the occupied territories. Guterres said one miscalculation, one miscommunication, one mistake could lead to the unthinkable, a full-scale regional conflict that would be devastating for all involved and for the rest of the world, he said. He called on Israel as the occupying power to protect the Palestinian population in the West Bank against violence and intimidation and allow safe passage for humanitarian aid into Gaza. Guterres said, "Let me be clear. The risks are spiraling on many fronts. We have a shared responsibility to address those risks and pull the region back from the precipice." Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu says Israel is considering retaliating against Tehran for its weekend missile and drone attack. Meanwhile, a senior commander in Iran's Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps said Thursday that Iran could alter its peaceful nuclear doctrine, and if Israel targets Iranian nuclear sites, we will surely and categorically reciprocate with advanced missiles against their own nuclear sites. Tehran has repeatedly claimed its nuclear program was for civilian purposes. Israel has accused Iran of attempting to obtain nuclear strike capability and has long pledged not to allow that to happen. Ahmad Haghtalab, the IRGC commander in charge of nuclear security, told Iran's semi-official Tasnia news agency, "The threats of the Zionist regime, Israel, against Iran's nuclear facilities make it possible to review our nuclear doctrine and deviate from our previous considerations," he said. Tehran's retaliatory attack came less than 2 weeks after an airstrike linked to Israel destroyed Iran's consulate in Damascus, killing several high-ranking Iranian military officers. The U.S. Treasury Department announced sanctions Thursday for 16 people and multiple companies linked to Iran's production of drones used in Iran's unprecedented attack. The sanctions target the Iranian drone program and steel and auto industries accused of working on behalf of Iran's Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps. The department statement notes that Iran's metals sector generates several billion dollars in revenue annually, mostly from steel exports. The sanctions were coordinated with Britain and in consultation with partners and allies, the statement said. Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen said, "We are using Treasury's economic tools to degrade and disrupt key aspects of Iran's malign activity, including its UAV program and the revenue the regime generates to support its terrorism." The European Council also said new sanctions would be imposed on Iran's drone and missile programs as punishment for the attack on Israel. Tehran, before launching its retaliatory strikes at Israeli targets, notified U.S. officials that American military bases and interests in the region would not be targeted unless Washington aided in Israeli attacks on Iranian interests, a top Iranian official said Thursday. White House National Security spokesperson John Kirby has said the United States did exchange messages with Iran, but has dismissed as ridiculous claims that U.S. officials were informed of Iran's time frame or targets. Iranian Foreign Minister Hossein Amirdollahian told the Islamic Republican news agency the messages were exchanged through the Swiss embassy, which represents U.S. interests in Iran, in order to prevent the escalation of tensions. Iran had exercised restraint, considering the regional conditions, but reportedly asked the UN Secretary General and the Security Council to fulfill their duties and confront Israel's actions. Tehran then decided to initiate the strikes on Israeli targets. Israel said 99% of the approximately 350 suicide drones, cruise missiles, ballistic missiles, and rockets launched from Iran, Iraq, Yemen, and Hezbollah in Lebanon were intercepted. Two-thirds of Gaza residents have been destroyed or damaged since the war began, UNICEF reported. The war was triggered when Hamas attacked southern Israel from Gaza on October 7, 2023, killing 1,200 people and taking 250 hostages into the enclave, according to Israeli tallies. Israel has retaliated by pounding Gaza in an air and ground offensive that has killed almost 34,000 Palestinians, according to Gaza health authorities. A special State Department panel recommended months ago that U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken disqualify multiple Israeli military and police units from receiving U.S. aid after reviewing allegations of serious human rights abuses, ProPublica reported. Blinken has thus far not acted on the recommendations. The United States and Israel were scheduled to hold a virtual meeting on Thursday about Israel's planned military operation in Rafah, Reuters reported, citing a U.S. official it did not name. The U.S. and most of the world has been urging Israel to drop plans for an invasion of the southern Gaza city that has been overwhelmed by Palestinians fleeing fighting elsewhere in the enclave. Qatar, meanwhile, is reevaluating its role as mediator in ceasefire talks between Israel and Hamas, citing concerns that its efforts are being undermined by politicians seeking to score points, its prime minister said Wednesday.
Thank you, Judith. And here's an article from the Nation and News, our Nation and World Extra section of the paper on page 6NN, entitled Biden Wins Kennedy Family Endorsement. 15 members of the storied Kennedy political family endorsed President Joe Biden at a Philadelphia campaign event on Thursday, with some joining him on stage in a rebuke of Robert F. Kennedy Jr.'s independent bid for office. Biden, a Democrat, faces Republican Donald Trump in a November rematch of the 2020 election, but members of both parties have bristled over the possibility that the candidacy of Kennedy, a prominent anti-vaccine activist, or another third-party bid could spoil either of their chances. Kennedy, son of the slain U.S. Senator and presidential candidate Robert F. Kennedy, made his name as an environmental lawyer before becoming known as an anti-vaccine advocate with an eclectic mix of political views. He is backed by 15% of registered voters versus 39% for Biden and 38% for Trump, according to a recent Reuters Ipsos poll. Many in Robert F. Kennedy Jr.'s elite family, prominent Democrats since the 19th century, have broken with him over his views. I can only imagine how Donald Trump's outrageous lies and behavior would have horrified my father, Robert F. Kennedy, Robert F. Kennedy Jr.'s younger sister, Carrie Kennedy, said at the Biden campaign event, calling Trump the most anti-democratic president ever. Daddy stood for equal justice, human rights, and freedom from want and fear, just as President Biden does today. A vote for Joe Biden is a vote for our democracy and our decency, Carrie Kennedy added. She did not mention her candidate brother in her speech. She added that she and her family were at the event because they feel obligated to do all they can to support Biden's campaign. Kennedy's family members are then expected to join local volunteers in door knocking and phone banking on Biden's behalf, campaign aides said. Robert F. Kennedy Jr. said on social media platform X, Biden, I am pleased they are politically active. It's a family tradition, he wrote. We are divided in our opinions, but united in our love for each other. The event on Thursday was part of Biden's third day this week in Pennsylvania, a critical swing state for his reelection bid. Biden needs strong turnout from Philadelphia's black community to win the state, and the Kennedys became icons because of their advocacy for civil rights. For its part, the Democratic National Committee has emphasized donations supporting Robert F. Kennedy Jr.'s candidacy from billionaire Timothy Mellon, a major MAGA Incorporated donor, pushing the concept that Kennedy is a stalking horse for Trump. That differs from the approach of those supporting Trump, including the Make America Great Again, Inc. super PAC, which has aimed to paint Kennedy as a leftist radical. The efforts by the two parties underscore concerns they both have that Kennedy could take votes away from their candidate. Biden, only the second Catholic president after John F. Kennedy, has long spoken how he was inspired by the family's legacy and added on Thursday that the family member's endorsement was an incredible honor. In his 2007 book, Promises to Keep, Biden describes himself as moved to get into public service by the Kennedy brothers and the activist Martin Luther King Jr., swept up in their eloquence, their conviction, the sheer size of their improbable dreams. When Biden was later elected to Congress, fellow Senator Ted Kennedy would become one of his closest friends. Ted, John, and Robert Sr. were brothers.
And from page 4, Johnson & Johnson wins trial in Florida after baby powder cancer claim. This story by Dietrich Knuth from Reuters. From New York City. A Florida jury on Thursday concluded that Johnson & Johnson's baby powder talc product did not cause the ovarian cancer of a Florida woman who died in 2019. The lawsuit was brought by family members of Patricia Mathey, a Sarasota County resident who used Johnson's baby powder daily from 1965 until August 2016, when she was diagnosed with ovarian cancer, according to her family's lawsuit. J&J's worldwide vice president of litigation, Eric Haas, said the company was vindicated by the jury's decision. He said, consistent with decades of scientific research, the jury appropriately found that talc is safe, does not contain asbestos, and does not cause cancer, which is the same outcome the company achieved in 16 of 17 ovarian cases tried to date, he said. Lee Odell, an attorney for the Mathey family, said she respects the jury's decision, but will remain undeterred in future cases against Johnson & Johnson. Odell said, the science supports the association between genital talc use and ovarian cancer, and we will continue to seek justice for the victims of Johnson & Johnson's neglect and indifference. Before her death, Mathey testified that advertisements for baby powder made her think that she was dirty and smelly, and that she needed Johnson's baby powder to be a good, clean person, according to evidence presented by her family's attorney, Lance Oliver, during the trial. The Mathey family alleged that J&J knew for decades that the talc it mined for use in baby powder could be contaminated with carcinogenic asbestos fibers. Johnson & Johnson suppressed scientific evidence linking talc products to increased cancer risk, according to the complaint. J&J argued that there was no conspiracy to suppress research. Instead, the scientific evidence simply does not support the Mathey family's claims that its talc products cause cancer, according to J&J. J&J's attorney, Morty Dubin, said during opening statements in the trial, this is fundamentally a case about science. Johnson & Johnson faces more than 50,000 lawsuits over talc, most by women with ovarian cancer, with a minority of the cases involving people with mesothelioma. Asbestos exposure is a known cause of mesothelioma. J&J has attempted to reach a comprehensive settlement of the talc litigation through bankruptcy, but courts have rejected its two previous attempts. Haas has said the company is considering a third bankruptcy filing and is trying to build more support for a bankruptcy settlement among the plaintiffs that have sued the company. Haas said on Thursday that J&J will continue to defend the meritless talc claims in the tort system while those negotiations continue. Johnson & Johnson's bankruptcy strategy put the talc litigation on hold from 2021 to 2023, but trials have resumed after the latest bankruptcy case was dismissed. Trials in the talc cases have had a mixed record, with major plaintiff wins including a $2.1 billion judgment in 2021 awarded to 22 women with ovarian cancer. A New Jersey appeals court in October threw out a $223.7 million verdict against the company, finding the testimony of the plaintiff's expert witnesses unsound. The most recent case to go to trial ended in a hung jury on March 5th. Johnson & Johnson has recently settled some cases involving plaintiffs with mesothelioma, but the company has not provided details about the dollar amounts involved or said how many people they covered.
Now here's some brief articles from the 50 states page. First, the highlighted state, Colorado today, Denver, Colorado. When a highly pathogenic strain of avian flu started killing tens of thousands of waterfowl in the state in 2022, Colorado raptor biologists feared it also would heavily impact bald eagles and hawks. What those biologists are finding is that while the state's raptors did take a hit in deaths and nesting failure at first, it wasn't nearly as much as initially feared. They also are seeing raptor numbers rebound better than expected in Colorado. Colorado Parks and Wildlife is reporting the state is home to more than 300 occupied bald eagle nests, the highest number on record. And from right here in Iowa, the Boone City Council has approved a proposal by dairy products maker Daisy Brand to locate a plant in Boone that would bring 255 jobs to the city. From Springfield, Illinois, Illinois lawmakers are targeting youth vaping this session, but a local business is ringing alarm bells with claims of unintended consequences. Rates of youth vaping among high schoolers actually decreased in 2023 after years of increased use, according to a report. Yet, both Democratic and Republican lawmakers find regulatory holes allowing the sale of particular products and advertising to children that they say need to be addressed in Springfield. From Indianapolis, Indiana, the U.S. Department of Justice has been brought in by the Indianapolis Police Department to examine the increase of shootings involving the city's officers last year, which reached a level not seen since 2016. From Topeka, Kansas, Kansas lawmakers and Governor Laura Kelly have repealed a law requiring regular audits of all the state's economic development programs. From Minnesota, St. Paul, the 2024 presidential election is predicted to be one of the closest in recent history between two unpopular candidates, and despite Minnesota voting for a Democrat for over 50 years straight, a victory for President Joe Biden isn't guaranteed. Springfield, Missouri, a Missouri lawmaker who lives in Ozark and represents part of Christian County, has asked Springfield Public Schools to turn over records in a quest to find out why two teachers are no longer working at Central High School. Their exit has been the subject of much speculation. And Bismarck, North Dakota, state officials broke ground on a new $70 million state laboratory on Capitol grounds to mark the beginning of its construction, the Bismarck Tribune reported. From South Dakota, Sioux Falls, a one-year-old child who fell from a third-story hotel window in Sioux Falls has died, according to a public Facebook post by the child's mother. And from Wisconsin, in Milwaukee, newly released reports raise questions about the financial viability of Wisconsin's public universities and signal additional cuts coming to some campuses in future years. For the last 90 minutes, your readers have been Judith Linden and myself, Scott Splavik. It's been our pleasure to read for you. Now we'll take a short break to allow our next readers to get into place.
Welcome back. Your new readers are Jim Hoffman, and my name is Rachel Mithelman. We'll continue now with articles from the Des Moines Register and USA Today. It's time to turn to the opinion page. So here is Jim with the first article.
Thank you, Rachel, and good morning, everyone. We are on the USA Today opinion page, and the first article we have here is written by Stephen E. Moore. He is founder of the Ukraine Freedom Project, which raises money to aid Ukrainians. And he moved from the United States to Kyiv just 5 days after Russia invaded Ukraine. Russia killing, torturing Christians. Send aid. Representative Marjorie Taylor Greene, Republican from Georgia, describes herself as a Christian nationalist, but doesn't seem to know much about Christians outside our nation. In a move that would have made Soviet propagandists proud, she has claimed that Russia is a protector of Christianity. In a podcast with Steve Bannon, Greene said Russia is not attacking Christianity. As a matter of fact, they seem to be protecting it. Protecting it? Greene was apparently unaware of the numerous reports from reputable religious freedom organizations and Christian groups and publications accusing Russia of torturing and killing religious leaders. In February, the International Religious Freedom or Belief Alliance, a group with 38 member countries, asserted that Russia has killed 30 Ukrainian religious leaders and held 26 captive in the past 2 years. For example, in November 2022, Russian forces in the small Ukrainian city of Nova Kakhovka abducted evangelical deacon Anatoly Prokopchuk and his 19-year-old son. Days later, in a nearby forest, the two were found dead with signs of torture so brutal their friends said they were mutilated beyond recognition, according to the Religious Information Service of Ukraine. Several evangelicals who thankfully survived torture have shared their horrifying stories. Azat Azatyan, a Baptist children's pastor who helps oppressed Christians flee Russian-occupied parts of Ukraine, was captured by Russian security services on his 25th evacuation trip. After dragging him to a basement where he spent the next 43 days, they put a bag over his head, handcuffed his hands to his legs, and connected electrical wires to his genitals. While torturing him, Azatyan said, "They mocked me for being a Baptist. To Russians, Baptists are American spies, and they beat me so badly that they thought I was dead." Azatyan survived. "I truly knew that my God was with me." Baptist pastor Oleksandra Salfanitkov was abducted by Russians in May 2022, driven to a detention center, thrown into a cell, interrogated, and beaten for 3 days. He said his captors were once convinced that all evangelical believers are American spies and wanted him to confess. His arm was broken. He couldn't walk. His body was swollen. He collapsed and fell unconscious. When he woke up, he was in the basement of a medical institution with his wife by his side. He survived, and after the Ukrainians won back control of Balaklia, he returned to his church. Apparently, torturing and killing individuals isn't enough. The Russian fighters have also gone after entire congregations in Ukraine. On September 11, 2022, 20 armed Russian soldiers burst in on the worship service at Grace Evangelical Church in the occupied city of Melitopol. And Reverend Mikhailo Briston told the PBS NewsHour one soldier took over the stage, telling women and children to go downstairs to be fingerprinted. The Russians copied worshippers' IDs and took photos. It's horrifying to think about what they can do with this information, Britson said. Other Christian churches have suffered similar crackdowns, and scores across occupied areas have been shut down. Under surveillance and risking persecution, these believers are now forced to worship in secret in their homes. This week is critical for both Congress and global stability, as House Speaker Mike Johnson, Republican from Louisiana, moves to advance military aid bills for Israel, Taiwan, and Ukraine. Green and a growing number of her far-right colleagues have been holding up the multi-billion dollar Ukraine military assistance package, which any Congress in the past half century would have easily approved. The Pentagon has spent more than $14 trillion since Vladimir Putin came to power in 2000, in part to deter Russia. It has not worked. The Ukrainians, however, have taken U.S. aid and cut Putin's warfighting capability in half. Most Republicans disagree with Green and others opposing Ukraine aid. In fact, two committee chairmen said some of their House colleagues are spouting Russian propaganda. Republican Mike McCaul, Republican of Texas, chairman of the House Foreign Affairs Committee, told Puck News that Russian propaganda has infected a good chunk of my party's base, and I have to explain to them what's at stake, why Ukraine is in our national security interest. Representative Mike Turner, Republican from Ohio, chair of the House Intelligence Committee, agreed, telling CNN that anti-Ukraine, pro-Russia messages are being uttered on the House floor. It's now time for the House to brush aside those spreading Russian propaganda, to approve aid to Ukraine and prevent victory by a dictatorship that shuts down churches and tortures and kills Christians.
The next piece on the opinion page is by USA Today opinion editor Thuan Lee Elston. She is the author of a book called Rendezvous at the Altar, From Vietnam to Virginia. She writes, on the red carpet recently for the Los Angeles premiere of HBO's new miniseries, The Sympathizer, she is regal in gold and black silk, glittering among Hollywood stars Robert Downey Jr. and Sandra Oh. You'd never know that 5 decades ago this month, actress Q Chin was homeless among the clouds, as she accounts in her memoir, Q Chin, An Artist in Exile, about how she became an accidental movie star in her native Vietnam and her refugee journey as Saigon fell in 1975. Yet with the trauma of a survivor, here she is reliving the Vietnam War in, quote, an espionage thriller and cross-culture satire, end quote, based on Viet Thanh Nguyen's Pulitzer Prize-winning novel. The miniseries, also streaming Sundays on Max, features award-winning filmmaker Park Chan-wook and Downey, who just won a Best Supporting Actor Oscar for Oppenheimer. I am so proud of our entire production for bringing to life a Pulitzer Prize-winning novel about a Vietnamese story adapted and played by a majority Vietnamese cast, especially our new young star, Hoa Quan Da, as the captain, Q Chin told me. As a period piece, you can imagine when we're shooting some of these visually stunning scenes, it was extremely emotional, said Q Chin, who is 86, For me, it was like reliving the past. For Nguyen, the novelist, who alluded to Kyu Chin's refugee story in The Sympathizer, it's more than appropriate that she appears in the TV adaptation of his bestseller. Kyu Chin is a legend of Vietnamese cinema and popular culture, he emailed me. Vietnamese audiences adore her, and she has played prominent roles in American cinema as well, from the Joy Luck Club to Journey from the Fall. A legend of Vietnamese cinema and popular culture. That's exactly what Kyu Chin was throughout my childhood, even after my family escaped the fall of Saigon and resettled in Phoenix in 1975. For as long as I could remember, images of her beauty and elegance made me think that she rivaled American legend Grace Kelly. In Saigon during the war, the Kyu Chin TV show featured Hollywood celebrities of the USO tour who came to help entertain service members such as Danny Kaye, Glenn Ford, and Tippi Hedren. It was Tippi Hedren, star of such films as Alfred Hitchcock's The Birds, and mother to actress Melanie Griffith and grandmother to actress Dakota Johnson, who sponsored Kyu Chin to the United States in the late 1970s. Then in 1977, Alan Alda wrote and starred in a MASH episode in which Kyu Chin played Hawkeye's love interest called In Love and War. Though MASH took place during the Korean War, the show premiered toward the end of the Vietnam War and was considered a commentary on how U.S. policy affected my birthplace. Watching that episode with my parents, I understood that they were proud of Kyu Chin and sad at the same time for her interrupted career as well as for our native land. Cinema wasn't done with Kyu Chin, however. She found herself starring in The Joy Luck Club, which came out in 1993. Coincidentally, I landed a role in an Oliver Stone movie that premiered the same year, Heaven and Earth. It was unbelievable enough for me, a journalist, to have 15 minutes of dialogue in a Hollywood film, but at our movie premiere in Los Angeles, I turned around and was suddenly face to face with the movie star of my childhood, Kyu Chin. That night, I called my mom in Phoenix to brag about meeting the Vietnamese icon. And if my dad hadn't passed away just a couple of years before, he would have been so jealous. Kyu Chin and I have stayed in touch over the years. Recently, when I called to congratulate her on The Sympathizer, the icon, born in 1937, was just so thrilled to have found a new generation of young fans who follow her on Facebook and Instagram. Every time she posts something, she's excited they respond with so many likes and comments. She's also excited about continuing to find work in Hollywood. Her social media posts are full of her leaving yet another airport, titled On the Road Again. If it seems like I've been working nonstop, it's because I have, Kyu Chin wrote me. Since wrapping HBO and A24's The Sympathizer in Thailand, I literally went directly from set to set, landing in Philadelphia the next day to film Apple TV Plus's Sinking Spring by producer and director Sir Ridley Scott and creator-director Peter Craig. I asked what it's like working with Robert Downey Jr., who plays multiple ugly American roles in The Sympathizer. Kyu Chin replied, "I was in awe of his work all season long. I wouldn't be surprised that the Academy Award winner will win an Emmy for this series."
Thank you, Rachel. And we turn to the sports in the Des Moines Register for a little bit here. First of all, the sports on TV. We've got today National Basketball Association, the NBA, at 8:30 this evening on TNT. They are televising Sacramento at New Orleans. And then the baseball, there's quite a few Major League Baseball games starting at 1:20 this afternoon. Major League Baseball Network, Miami at the Chicago Cubs. At 5:40 on ESPN+, we have the LA Angels at Cincinnati. at 6:20, Apple TV Plus, we get Texas Rangers and Atlanta Braves. At 7:10 this evening, Major League Baseball Network, Detroit at Minnesota. At 7:15 on Major League Baseball Network, Milwaukee at St. Louis. At 8:40, Major League Baseball Network also, Toronto at San Diego. At 9:10, Major League Baseball Network, the Mets against the Dodgers. And then at 9:15 on Apple TV Plus, Arizona at San Francisco. And then we have the Athletes of the Week. Brownlee Zondervan, voted Athletes of the Week. This written by Joe Randleman of the Des Moines Register. Clear Lake girls track and field athlete Reese Brownlee and Carlisle boys track and field athlete Braden Zondervan were voted the Des Moines Register Iowa Ortho Female and Male Athlete of the Week winners for the week of April 8th to the 14th. Brownlee dominated the Female Athlete of the Week voting with 85% of the vote. Gilbert girls golfer Eden Lorbach took second with 8%. Brownlee ran the fastest 400 meet hurdle time in Iowa for high school girls track during the Hanover Relays in Algona April 9th. Brownlee clocked in at 1 minute 1.95 seconds to win the 400 hurdles by over 11 seconds. Wow. Zondervan easily won the Male Athlete of the Week after receiving 76% of the vote. Dowling Catholic boys track and field thrower Nathan Rotherham took second with 19%. Zondervan turned in an impressive performance in the 400-meter dash for the Carlisle boys track and field team Saturday at the Jim Duncan Invitational in Des Moines. Zondervan won the boys' open 400 in 47.75 seconds. His time was nearly 2 seconds faster than the runner-up effort by Dowling Catholic's Travis Limbequa.
We have a few minutes before we go to Dear Abby, so a few short articles. Gerlich named as executive director of IGHSAU. This is by Alyssa Hurdle. The Iowa Girls High School Athletic Union named its successor to former executive director Gene Berger on Thursday. Erin Gerlich, who served in other roles with the union before her promotion, was named the new executive director of IGHSAU. She said in a statement released by the organization, "I am deeply honored to be selected as the next IGHSAU executive director. I am committed to leading the organization toward continued success in my new position. I look forward to championing the growth and empowerment of female athletes across Iowa." She previously held the position of associate director and sport administrator within the union. In those roles, she served as the head of emerging sports and new projects, led sports medicine coordination efforts, and was the administrator for wrestling and tennis, according to an IGHSAU release. Gerlich played a large part in introducing girls wrestling to Iowa. She earned the Charlotte Bailey Award, honoring an individual who made significant efforts for the advancement of girls wrestling in Iowa, from the Iowa Wrestling Coaches and Officials Association in 2023. She also won the AAU Wrestling Women's Empowerment Award. Gerlich served as president of the Iowa High School Athletic Directors Association from 2022 to 2023. Making her the first female to hold the position. The Panora native will officially assume her new role on June 8th. And then some story or some news about a former Cyclone by Randy Peterson. Former Iowa State basketball star Tyrese Halliburton will be a U.S. Olympian. The Oshkosh, Wisconsin native who starred for the Cyclones in 2018-19, excuse me, in 2019-20, was one of 12 players in USA Basketball selected Wednesday to play in the 2024 Paris Olympics. He's the second former Cyclones men's basketball player selected to a U.S. Olympic team. Halliburton is on a star-studded U.S. team that includes Kevin Durant, LeBron James, Bam Adebayo, Devin Booker, Stephen Curry, Anthony Davis, Anthony Edwards, Joel Embiid, Drew Holiday, Kawhi Leonard, and Jason Tatum. The U.S. men have competed in basketball at the Olympics 19 times, winning 16 gold medals, 1 silver, and 2 bronze. Jeff Grayer represented Iowa State and helped the U.S. to a bronze medal in the 1988 Seoul Olympics. Halliburton was the 12th pick of the Sacramento Kings in the 2020 NBA draft. He was traded to the Indiana Pacers in February of 2022. The Paris Games are held between July 26th and August 11th of this year. It's time to turn to Dear Abby. There are two letters, so I'll take the first one, and if you'll take the second one, Jim. Dear Abby, I have a 25-year-old niece, Meadow, who embraces the hippie lifestyle. She's kind and sweet and loves everyone. She has also opposed the establishment. She's heavily tattooed and has several facial piercings and thick underarm hair. My son is the complete opposite. He is in the business world and is very professional in his manner and dress. He's getting married in 3 months to a lovely girl. Meadow is invited because she wanted to come. My son is nervous about her coming to the wedding. He doesn't know Meadow that well. They were close as kids, but haven't seen much of each other in adulthood. My son is worried Meadow will wear an outfit that will display the tattoos and her bushy underarm hair. He's afraid she will be a spectacle, and her appearance will become the focus of the wedding and not his lovely bride. He's also worried someone will ridicule or comment about Meadow, and he will then have to defend her, causing a disruption. None of us are close to Meadow or feel comfortable with her appearance. How do we handle her presence at the wedding? Signed, Conforming in Carolina. Abby writes, Dear Conforming, excuse me, who invited this counterculture cousin to the wedding? The time to have raised these issues was before the invitations were sent out. If Meadow is already invited, it would be terrible to disinvite her. If someone comments on her appearance, I'm sure it won't be the first time she has heard of it. If it happens, resist the urge to rush to her defense. Simply explain calmly that Meadow is there because she's family. That's the truth. As to her upstaging your son's bride, that won't happen if Meadow is seated at a distance from the altar.
Thanks, Rachel. And the second letter, Dear Abby, I've been regularly attending exercise classes that are offered with the membership at my gym. One of the classes I particularly enjoy is taught by a very good instructor who is friendly and welcoming. She makes a point of speaking to everyone in attendance. I have noticed over the last few weeks she has become decidedly unfriendly toward me. She avoids speaking to me even though she speaks to everyone else in the class. This has been upsetting and I realize I'm becoming depressed about it. I'm not aware of anything I have done to provoke this. Should I ask her if there was something I did to offend? Should I say nothing and continue attending her classes? Or should I just join other classes that are offered at my gym? I occasionally see her participating in other exercise classes I attend, and sometimes we are in the gym working out at the same time. Signed, Alienated Gym Guy in Georgia. So Abby writes, Dear Gym Guy, I'm a firm believer in the adage, seek and ye shall find. Because this teacher seems to have cooled to you and you alone, pose that question. then be prepared for an honest answer.
And that brings us to the end of the Des Moines Register for today, Friday, April 19th. My name is Rachel Mithelman, and my partner at the microphone has been Jim Hoffman. Earlier, you heard Scott Splavik and Judith Linden. You can listen to IRIS programs on any computer or smart device at any time at iowaradioreading.org. Support for today's reading comes from the Des Moines Register, Iowa Public Radio, Iowa PBS, and bensoundmusic.com. Thank you for listening to IRIS, Iowa's first and only radio reading service.